welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are, this is Eric.
By the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex? Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen, and not a one of you is prepared for it.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road, and you know, anyway. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
This is Drew.
And tonight we have two movies in one. We have 1948's Rope, and we have 1954's Dial M for Murder, both directed by the master of suspense, Alfred Hitchcock.
Indeed.
So,
sorry.
No, go ahead. Brother Jay, you're the Hitchcock expert.
Well, I'm no expert, but...
Well, you have a Hitchcock collection.
I do have a Hitchcock collection, but
that makes you the expert. Among the three of us.
Okay. I guess if you qualify it that way, that's probably a true statement. So I have the Hitchcock collection, by the way, which does not have Dial M for Murder. So explain that. I don't know. But
I think we'll have an answer to that question.
I should say that. So we watched, boyfriend Jesse and I watched Dial M for Murder first, and then we watched Rope, I think. That's the right order, right?
Against specific orders.
Oh, no. We watched them in the order that we were supposed to. I just don't remember.
Rope was first.
Oh, yeah.
Just okay. Chronological. Rope was first. I mean, it just doesn't really matter, but I think going from Rope to Dial M is a progression.
Oh, no. I watched Dial M for Murder first.
Well, either way.
Anyway, but we watched both of those, and then after that, it was revealed that he had never seen Psycho.
Really?
And so I have, apparently, by the way, I have all of the Hitchcock collection that I have on Blu-ray have been pulled apart and remastered for sound.
Oh, excellent.
So it's full surround sound stereo that's been pulled apart element by element. So clear in some cases from the original mono master that they said in some parts you could actually like hear birds in the studio barn that were chirping over the filming. So it was kind of wild. So it was very.
Did you watch it?
Yeah, we watched Psycho. So we did that on top of.
We got to talk about Psycho and get boyfriend Jesse on, because I'm curious to see how he felt about one of my favorite movies.
And I won't spoil anything about that other than.
But he knew about it, right? I mean, he was familiar with the premise of Psycho.
No.
Oh, he didn't know the twist.
Mm-mm.
Wow.
No.
He didn't know about the shower scene or anything?
Nope.
You've never made him watch High Anxiety?
Not yet. I didn't want him to run away. You know, family is one thing. They can't run away. They keep coming back, but...
You calling me fat? I can run from a bear, damn it.
But no, so he knew of, like, he said, hey, there was a series like Bates Motel, and I was like, kinda, but not this quite the same. So he was aware that it existed, but I don't think had a clear understanding of the plot or any of the moving parts. So at the denouement, he was quite surprised.
Ah, it's such a good movie.
So, yeah, we will have him on, and you can hear his... You will be able to relive the discovery of the first time of fulfilling the viewing of Psycho. So, and I got to say, it holds up really well.
Just got to read the book.
Yeah. Well, you know, Hitchcock bought all the copies of the book so that nobody could have it. When the movie released.
I'm sorry. I misspoke. I don't suggest that he reads the Robert Block Psycho, because that's a whole different thing. But I think he should read the book about the making of Psycho.
Oh, I see. Well, I would be fascinated by that.
Oh, it's a fascinating book. It's on Audible, too.
I think there was an hour and a half documentary that came on the Blu-ray that I watched that Jesse said, why are you still watching this? This is as long as the movie. Because there was so much stuff talking about how they cast people and how like Hitchcock's daughter was in it. And
he hasn't listened to the episode where the three of us talk about Good Will Hunting, followed by a second podcast where we talk about the commentary track to Good Will Hunting.
You know, I have never seen that movie.
It's worth seeing.
There's lots of movies that are worth seeing, but...
Yeah. No, it's on the list for a reason.
Limited resource and limited time. I'll get to it when I have to, but probably not much before. Although, later in housekeeping...
It's not your fault.
I do have housekeeping. But we should probably talk about Rope and Dial M for Murder, since that's what we're supposed to be talking about.
I guess I want your overall reaction to both movies, starting with Brother Jay.
So I will say, I've seen Dial M for Murder before. I had never seen Rope before. So Dial M for Murder was okay. It wasn't great. It was it was hard to say that it's great because watching it again, it just felt like I knew every beat that was coming. But having said that, the cinematography, the camera angles, and the lighting and the set and all the atmosphere is still incredible, especially considering all of that's practical effects, all of it's real life stuff. None of it's fake smoke and mirrors per se. Not like today. So a movie like that today would probably not get made. Also because the plot was kind of bad. So Rope was actually, I thought, pretty fantastic. It was dark. It was a very dark movie. And it was kind of fun to see Jimmy Stewart in a dark role. And it was also funny to me to watch them skirting around the whole gay couple issue. Never mentioning it, but it was latent and obvious.
Oh, this was banned in some cities.
Yeah. That's what the
Was it really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, I mean, you had the Hays Code, so
you had, yeah.
So you had some of that element going where Hollywood had not quite eschewed the moral decency act of filmmaking, where the villain couldn't get away with it. So,
oh yeah, no, everybody, there were no men and women together on a bed without at least 1 foot on the floor, and the bad guys could never win.
Yeah, actually, so I pointed that out in Psycho that he said, "See, his feet are on the floor."
Oh, that's funny.
So
Drew, what was your first reaction?
I had never seen either of these movies before, and apparently I watched them in the wrong order as well. I thought they're both okay. I think I liked Rope more. Dial M for Murder, I think it was trying to be a little bit too clever. I did, like Jason said, I did enjoy the filmmaking of it. It made really tremendous use of really small, limited sets. I mean, it essentially almost entirely takes place in one room. I thought that was really effective. Grace Kelly was really pretty. I think I've only seen her in one movie before. But yeah, I thought it was okay. Some of the pivotal plot points were so dated, I thought it was distracting. But it was fine. I wasn't mad at it. But I liked Rope quite a bit. I thought Rope was really creepy. I did enjoy watching Jimmy Stewart play kind of a dick.
Yeah, that's actually in my notes.
I had not seen that before. He was good at it. I wish the ending had been a little bit darker. I was really distracted because I thought, what was his name? Was his name Brandon? The one who was like really into the murder?
Yes. John Dahl.
He looked like a young Jason Sudeikis to me.
Oh,
so
see.
That was really distracting me throughout the movie.
See, I wrote that John Dahl is a Ben Affleck handsome motherfucker.
But I don't know. I liked it. There's so much tension done really well in that movie. And everybody was pretty much unlikable.
Also in my notes.
So it was a lighthearted, dark movie, which was great. I liked it quite a bit.
And, I mean, the whole making of it, when you realize that Hitchcock wanted it as a continuous take movie. And so all of it was shot in 8-minute single takes, because that was the maximum that the film canisters could hold, was 8 minutes. And so you have single takes where they have everything, and the sets, they would move from room to room, and the crew would have to move the sets in and out and restage things. And at one point in the movie, I noticed you could see the tape on the floor where they were supposed to put something back and miss the mark.
Yeah, people got hurt because of all the camera movement and behind-the-scenes stuff. I mean, that was interesting. I mean, this is actually a play, and it's a play that was adapted for the screen by Hume Cronyn.
Amazing. Mr. Jessica Tandy.
Yeah. Cocoon's own Hume Cronyn.
Well, that's not all he did.
Oh, no. He's a legend. At least he was in the Love Boat a bunch of times.
Well, also, it's based on a true story.
Well, yeah, that's what I thought I told you about that it's all Leopold and Loeb. And
right.
It's not true to life. I mean, it's not, the kid they actually killed, I think, was like a young teen. And in this, it's a peer. But yeah, it's kind of this, starting with rope. This is a very simple story that was trying to have a lot of deep thinking in it, and I think succeeded in some of it. I mean, they mentioned the whole Nietzsche, like, Übermensch theory, and the whether or not there are people that are, like, above the law or better than other people, that kind of thing. Smarter. If you're smarter and well-educated, you're a better person and more valuable. And yeah, all of the characters are pretty unlikable. I don't know. I really enjoyed it. I thought that the two main characters are Philip, played by the guy with the best name and the worst face, Farley Granger, or the most boring face. And then the handsome-faced but boring-named Brandon John Dahl. And I was trying to look for other John Dahl movies, and so one of them is Gun Crazy. And so I watched part of clips of Gun Crazy on YouTube, and it's not all that great. But this was Hitchcock's first color movie. That's why
the sets were built as they were, because they were to, first of all, he wanted to show off the color as much as he could, but the cameras were so gigantic that the sets had to accommodate that.
And it was also a very, a one room pretty much movie. There's actually, apparently in the trailer for this movie, there's actually a scene with the guy who gets killed in the first 20 seconds of the movie.
Yeah.
Like, him and the girlfriend are, like, on a park bench.
Yep.
Oh.
And Jimmy Stewart's talking to, he breaks the fourth wall. Jimmy Stewart's talking to the audience.
I do want to. I just think we ought to wait till after you graduate.
I don't.
It's only a month.
Janet, a month?
Please.
Sorry. I personally consider us engaged as of now. Congratulations.
David, no.
Look, you can say yes in a taxi. I have a 2:30 appointment.
I'm staying right here.
Oh? Afraid you'll say yes?
I'll see you tonight at Brandon's party.
Okay. You can say yes, sir, just as well as in a taxi. Goodbye, darling.
Bye.
That's the last time she ever saw him alive. And that's the last time you'll ever see him alive. What happened to David Kentley changed my life completely and the lives of seven others. Janet Walker, Henry Kentley, the boy's father, his aunt, Mrs. Atwater, his best friend, Kenneth Lawrence, a housekeeper named Mrs. Wilson, and the two who were responsible for everything, Brandon Shaw and Philip Morgan.
That's pretty fun stuff. I mean, the thing about Hitchcock, and I know I'm going to bring up Kubrick again, but you know, he was showing off. I mean, Hitchcock shows off just like all other auteur directors. He was pushing boundaries. You know, I mean, doing a Technicolor movie was a big deal, and doing a movie with all these gigantic long takes is a big deal. And so he, you know, obviously his films had to be financed by studio money, but still he pushed against all the conventions. And I just thought, you know, if you realize you're getting into basically like a stage play, movie, you could do a lot worse than this one. A little tangent. I saw The Music Man for the first time the other day. And, yeah, it's not good.
It's not good.
I don't enjoy it. I don't enjoy the music. I don't care about trombones. And I was waiting for when Paul Lynde would sing the song about kids. Turns out that's Bye Bye Birdie, an entirely different musical. Instead, we get Buddy Hackett, who is charming, but otherwise doesn't really speed anything up. And Shirley Jones is lovely, but I don't recommend The Music Man.
So, because you invoked Kubrick's name, I implore you now, for the next 20 episodes, you must do the 6 degrees of rope. So.
6 degrees of rope? Okay, we can make it happen. Pierce Brosnan dated Cedric Hardwick's great-granddaughter. He was Mr. Kentley, the father of David.
You're just making it up.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah, I know. This is a valiant effort.
So, but
what music would you do for that bit?
Exactly. Be like, tits on the radio again. Actually, that's more for Dial M. Yeah. So, Rope is a very simple story, and I love it. It's simple, and it's a comedy, because you've got a dead body in the first minute of the movie, and they stuff him into like it's basically what is that piece of furniture called? Like a chest. Like a chest with the top on it that you could, you know, if it's in the middle of like a living room area.
Like what, do they call it, a hope chest maybe?
There's got to be a name for it. But
maybe if we were alive in the 40s and 50s, we'd know.
And actually the worst part of the movie was when they killed David. Because it was not very realistic in any way. But that's okay. Didn't need to be.
Also made the trailer a lie because we saw David alive.
Well, yeah, briefly. But before we went...
wonder what his scale was.
I actually liked the beginning because I actually knew nothing about this movie. So that was a pretty spectacular way to start it off. It's pretty ballsy.
I'd never seen it before either. And I was like, oh, well, they just did that. So God, what's the rest of the movie going to be like? I had no idea what I was in for.
Yeah. And then they dump him into a chest.
Yeah.
Which they just basically, the rest of the movie, in some cases, literally revolves around the chest. I mean, everybody is getting close to this dead body, and there's always some, you know, sort of semi-comical tension about whether, you know, when these guys are going to get found out. And, you know, we have the housekeeper. By the way, these guys are unlikable. Everybody in this movie is rich, which is fine, but nobody seems to like work for a living. Everybody has these high-minded discussions or whatever. But I don't feel any kind of a connection to any of these characters.
There's not a socially redemptive bone in any of their bodies.
I have a hard time coming up with a more hateable person than like a 20-year-old elitist.
Yes, exactly. So in that case, it's kind of, you know, I mean, you want to see him get caught. They're sniping with each other at the same time as they're both, you know, neither of them want to get caught.
Do you think that this was Hitchcock's commentary and thumbing his nose at rich people and calling them out for being effete bastards?
He was a rich person.
Yeah, but who better to throw stones?
Maybe, but I don't think so, because he came from the English class system, and these were people in his class.
Yeah, but he was trying to make fun of them as Americans.
Maybe.
So that's kind of fitting justice. Like these fat, ugly, rude American people.
But remember, Britain was different at that time.
Oh, I know. I'm just saying.
What I got more out of it was aren't kids just a bunch of assholes?
Well, what about Jimmy Stewart's character? He was the former headmaster of the school, like their boarding school, high school, whatever, right? Or college prep school.
I hated him the first half of the movie. I wanted him to die.
He was a jackass from the beginning. And the fact that they claim to have gotten their ideas from him are basically they killed this guy to prove themselves superior, to prove that they could commit the perfect crime, but also kind of to impress their former headmaster.
Though they weren't going to tell him.
Yeah, he was a jerk, but he still like oozed charisma somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, he was still Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah. He was also genuine. I mean, he sold it. He really believed, he really drank the Kool-Aid, his own Kool-Aid, I guess.
Did he, or was his character like he was playing the role of a jerk? Like that, like, I don't mean his character is a jerk. I mean, like, his character was somebody who specialized in going to cocktail parties and putting on a jerk face because it made him more interesting.
Yeah, no, he was a jerk, but he was all talk. Like, he didn't believe the shit he was spewing.
Also, a reason to dislike college people. Everyone in a college town.
Distrust the educated.
No, just educated enough to be up their own ass.
Yep.
Oh, by the way, yes, this is coming from an uneducated old person. So old that I crossed a line that I can't uncross. And I realize I've crossed many, many, many lines I can't uncross. Some of them are just gross tonnage lines, but...
Hey, you made weight.
Well, I made weight that once, but it wasn't like I made a tremendous number. I just happened to squeeze in under what I said.
You didn't disappoint and crush our father's dream.
Yes, that's true. Although we're running from a bear, almost did it. We'll see. Anyway, so...
Well, I mean...
but it worked bait, out. It all worked out.
Bait, really, you know.
Yeah, no. No, so I am this guy now. I did not want to be this guy. I used to make fun of this guy. But I am the guy who, instead of typing in a time into the microwave, I'll just hit the add minute button.
Wait, that's just, sometimes that's just efficient.
Yeah, yeah. But I just see it as being just old. It's like, all these buttons, bleh, many.
Oh, see, like, when you live in a house like mine where your roommate destroyed your microwave 15 years ago and refuses to let you replace it, so there's no display, the only option I have is to hit 30 seconds over and over and over again because it's the only way I can count how long it's going to run for.
Well, I know what's on your birthday list.
So, you know, there's that. But, it's like at times if the power goes out and comes back on, I don't even bother to set the time on the stove.
I know.
Yep. Like, who cares?
I have that So Clean thing that cleans my my sleep mask. Also,
yeah.
Old fat person thing. And that
I had one of those.
Because it's not like on a UPS or anything. Every time the power goes out or it gets unplugged or something, the time resets. But just the time, not the settings.
Right.
So even though it's set to like start its little cycle at 10 o'clock in the morning when I'm theoretically at work or at least awake... often the time is never right, like by hours off. Don't care.
So you just hit manual clean every time?
Yeah. It's easy enough. I know when I take it off and flop it in there, and I want to make sure that it seals right, because I don't know about yours, but if you don't have it just precisely in there, it'll say the hose is not connected. I hate that message.
I actually haven't used mine in some time now. You. So, because I no longer have the apnea, but...
Sweet. Good for you.
I've got... No, well, I traded one devil for another because now I shallow breathe instead. So,
yeah, me too.
So, I was advised to use the CPAP when I feel fatigued, but I don't have apnea, so I stopped snoring. But I don't breathe, so you know, there's that.
Yeah, I found myself breathing like a fat guy. Walking helps that for me. But oh well,
hypoxia.
Turns out it's easy to breathe like a fat guy. But it's when some, like, another punchable face guy, Seth MacFarlane, makes fun of people who breathe like fat guys in cartoon form that he realizes, you know, you got to pay attention to that sort of thing. Get healthy, man. Wheat thins. Wheat.
Wheat. Yes.
Yeah, so we basically had just have like a comedy sort of thing where these guys, you know, one guy, especially Brandon, or no, I'm sorry, not Brandon, Philip, is the guy who's becoming unhinged. He's the musician. And Brandon is the suave guy who's like, what, an art dealer or something? And they're going to go live in their house in the country or something.
Philip is the chicken choker.
Yes, exactly. I never choked a chicken. I'm not going to choke any chickens. I know you choked a chicken. Well, Philip, I do believe you told me that you choked a chicken that one time. That's my Jimmy Stewart. It's not very good.
No, that's great. I knew exactly who you were doing.
Well, it's morning in America where you can choke a chicken.
Was like that Ronald Reagan?
Yeah, sadly. That's Richard Bill. It's Richard Belzer doing Ronald Reagan.
Oh, I thought it was Rich Little doing Ronald Reagan.
Oh, that would be a compliment.
You're welcome.
Anyway, so
I thought it was that weird puppet thing doing Ronald Reagan.
Oh, okay. Here's another tangent. Jeff Dunham. Okay. I used to like Jeff Dunham, and because I think ventriloquism is kind of fun, and. Then I listened to a lot of comedy podcasts where comedians kind of dismissed Jeff Dunham as a guy with the racist puppets. And then I watched
Ahmed.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I actually bought Kelly an Ahmed shirt one time. And then we realized that, okay, you can't wear that in public anywhere. It's offensive under all circumstances. Yeah, I watched a Jeff Dunham special lately, and yeah, that's what his routine is. He's a racist puppeteer. You know, for comedy, but they're all racial jokes. He travels the world and makes racist jokes. Or racial jokes, depending on, yeah. I'm sure he thinks they're racial, not racist, but, yeah.
Oh no, it's not Flea Daddy, it's Sweet Daddy! I'm happy to call you my new manager. I'm what you call a player in a management profession.
Right.
Pimp. You're a pimp? That makes you the hope. I'm not a whore. What do you do for a living? Make people laugh. Make them feel good, right? You the hope. That's not right. Why do you do what you do?
Why? Because I enjoy it and it's the best way I know to make money.
You the hope. Wait a minute. What if I said I do it only because I enjoy it? You the dumb hope.
So what ideas do you have for my career?
First thing I got to do is school you in street.
Word.
What?
Word. What word? What?
You said word.
Word.
What word? Oh, snap. What the hell? Dog, word is like, I heard that.
Heard what?
Oh, dog, you're not white. You are neon white. You so white, you make Barry Manilow look like a brother.
Wait, I like Barry Manilow.
Woo! Are you gay?
I'm not gay. You just white.
Yeah.
It's all good.
Yeah,
look. Do you think this is going to work between us?
Let's make an analogy here.
An analogy.
If we were food, I would be a fine summer wine that would be divine anytime.
What about me?
Every good wine needs a cracker.
Yeah, I think I watched one comedy special with him for an hour, and I thought, oh, he's kind of funny. And then I saw another hour, and I thought, oh, I never need to see him again and cross him off the list.
Exactly.
I'm good.
Makes me appreciate Carrot Top.
Do you guys remember like a stand-up comedy show that would be on like Saturday nights after like sort of in that time slot after Star Trek Next Generation? And it was just like an hour-long show where there would be four or five stand-up routines.
Like Evening at the Improv?
Is that what it was?
Was there a brick wall behind everybody?
Maybe.
Yeah, that would be Evening at the Improv.
Evening at the Improv, yeah.
So yeah, that was an hour-long show?
Yeah. I think so.
Okay. Yeah, so I think that was the only place I had ever seen Jeff Dunham. So he probably only had like 8-minute set. I can't imagine taking that guy for an hour.
Hour and a half.
Jeez.
Yeah. I mean, I realize there are comedians that just aren't for me. I mean, people who are just like, you know, they specialize in rape jokes and stuff. Like the Daniel Toshes of the world. Like, he's a funny guy, but he's just not for me.
I can't stand him.
Again, it's a to each your own. I don't care. But it's, I don't know. Like, I don't want to, I'm not going to spend any money on Daniel Tosh. I'm not sure why racist puppets came up while talking about rope, but.
Well, you are a tangent man, so. Yeah,
well.
It happens.
Yeah, I mean, basically my notes are that it was just fun. I would like to see the play. You know, it's just a fun little thing. It's like, it's suspense and tension, but it really is like a comedy. I mean, it's almost like The Trouble with Harry. Not quite as such a slapsticky level, but close.
The Trouble with Harry was my very first non-psycho Hitchcock movie. And it was so different than what I was expecting.
It doesn't hold up as well, maybe? I don't know. We'll have to check it out during our run of Hitchcock movies coming up after the Planet of the Apes retrospective we'll be doing here in the next year. yeah, so anything else about Rope? Other than we all kind of liked it?
Yeah, this is a movie I don't really want to give anything away because I had such a pure experience not knowing anything about it. I thought it was really interesting.
I had a few comments. I liked that it had, at this point in time, movie still had the full credits in the opening of the movie.
You prefer that?
I kind of like that. Because it irritates me, people who skip out before the credits are over. I'm like, all those people contributed to the movie. You should at least try and be respectful of the people in the credits. So, you know, I don't know. If I've bought the movie at home, it's different. But if you're in a theater, sit through the damn credits. So, but I know nobody agrees with me.
No, it's okay. No. I do it strictly from shame, so I don't miss any after credit sequences, like The Gray,
or perhaps Idiocracy, Upgrade. So I just had a couple comments. Like, clearly, I'm guessing there wasn't a lot of forensics in the 50s.
40s.
Well, 40s and 50s, but you know, there are some very odd moments, like the whole speech about good Americans die on the battlefield.
Yeah.
It was striking to me that the food was very colorful. Like, they went to great efforts to make sure that the food was very vibrant and colorful.
What about that dessert?
Yeah, well,
that dessert.
Yeah, the dessert where you could see the continuity error, so.
Oh, I didn't notice the continuity error.
Yeah, so every time the camera would do a close-up of the back of somebody, that's where the scene was cut,
yes.
Where the 8-minute mark was. And at one point, you see the ice cream, and then you see it at the cut, and it's completely configured differently. So it's either melted over the time, or it's different. So it's something I noticed. Everybody's smoking like a chimney, yes. And drinking like a fish. Lots of booze. Jesse said at one point that the Jimmy Stewart character was like, he was basically advocating a purge-like national day of murder by season, like, yep. Strangulation week.
Yeah, I thought of that too. I was like, somebody was watching this movie and then got the idea for the purge.
And then there was a pretty good backhanded bitch slap.
What was the, when the backhanded?
I think Brandon smacked Philip to snap him out of it.
Yeah. Well, also,
you know, because he was clearly the girl in the relationship.
it's weird because, you know, I sometimes think about when we talk about Dial In for Murder, we'll talk about this issue too. But I sometimes think about like the different roles of women just in society, maybe as portrayed by movies. And I was trying to figure out the the relative strength of the character of Janet, played by Joan Chandler. I mean, I thought she was great. And she seemed spunky enough. But she apparently had dated everybody.
She got around.
Yeah, well, and I mean, not even got around necessarily sexually, but yeah, dated everybody. Even dated Brandon. And of course, Brandon, like, trying to set her up with another guy, even though she's, like, her almost fiancé is supposed to show up at any point, which is just shows he's an evil guy. But yeah, I mean, I like the fact that nobody was likable. Not even the girl character was particularly likable, although there was nothing about her that I hated. I kind of liked the maid character, and I thought the aunt was funny. And the father would have been funny, except that he's the father, and he's very uncomfortable about the Jimmy Stewart's being very flip with murdering people. So it was nice. I thought the tone was nice, and it wasn't too long. I mean, it was like a
hour 50, maybe.
Yeah, not very long at all.
It was great.
Yeah. Anything else on Rope before we go to Dial M for Murder?
No, I have to say I watched it in the right order. Because I watched Dial M for Murder first, and I ended up with Rope. I'm glad I did it that way.
Okay. Just to set up Dial M for Murder a little bit. Dial M for Murder, of course, Alfred Hitchcock's first color picture was Rope. Dial M for Murder was Alfred Hitchcock's first and only 3D movie. Like, there, at the beginning of the film, there's a big finger that comes in and dials the numbers. Apparently, the camera, to get that shot right, because he was doing excellent camera work here, directing excellent camera work, they had to build, like, a 6-foot foam finger to make the 3D come out right. So,
there's no reason to have 3D for this movie.
No, but it was a big thing. In fact, the thing about this movie, Dial M for Murder, one of the reasons why it's not in the best of Hitchcock is because I don't think it was a movie that he liked very much. He was contractually obligated to make this picture for the studio, and they wanted it in 3D because that was the big fad, and he thought that was unnecessary. And he himself said, I'd probably, rather... like glibly, that the movie had as much action as you could pack into a phone booth, and then he basically dialed in his direction, he phoned in his direction.
The commentary said that it was a Paramount picture that got filmed at Universal Studios or vice versa.
But he owed somebody a movie. But it's got a pretty great cast. I mean, we have Ray Milland, who is great as Tony Wendice. Now, we know Ray Milland from Love Story, Rich Man, Poor Man, Escape to Witch Mountain, The Lost Weekend, and X, the Man with X-Ray Eyes. And we have his wife, Margot, played by Grace Kelly, who we know from Rear Window, High Noon, To Catch a Thief, and The Country Girl. Also, Car Crash. And then we have Margot's former... like lover, affair person, Mark Halliday, played by Robert Cummings from Saboteur and King's Row. I think he died young, the actor did.
They weren't still having an affair?
Oh, they probably were still having an affair, right?
That's what I thought.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, long distance, but... because this was a very British movie. This all took place like in British conservative upper class. Again, none of these characters are particularly likable either. Except, of course, for the policeman later. But, yeah, Ray Milland was great, but he wasn't likable. He was a former tennis player who had to quit the game. And his rich wife, who we find out in quick order. Okay, we find out first that his rich wife is cheating on him. And then we find out that not only does he know that she's cheating on him, but he's going to have her killed for... her insurance money and other riches. And then the plot gets super, super complicated, even though it's basically most of this movie, which, by the way, has an intermission in it. That's another, anachronism of these days. But until we get after the intermission into the courtroom scenes, this is all, like, in one room. This is Rope, except we don't have a dead body yet.
There are the scenes when he was out for the night.
Well, that's true.
Some dinner club.
Yeah. At his gentleman's club.
Yeah, but yeah, that was it.
I thought it was a beautifully shot movie, like you had said before, both of you. I really liked Ray Milland. I just thought his performance was great. I thought Grace Kelly, again, as Drew said, beautiful, but she doesn't have much to work with in this movie.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah, not only is her character not empowered, but she's also not likable, and on purpose. I mean, Hitchcock has this thing where, in the very beginning of the movie, she's wearing like all white when she's around her husband. But as the movie progresses, her clothing gets darker and darker, like first turns into red when she's with her lover. And then like by the end of the movie, she's wearing black because she's, you know, spoiler, going to death row, going to be hung for her crime.
How do you know it was red?
What do you mean?
It's black and white.
It's not a black and white movie.
I thought it was.
Pretty sure it's not.
It was
pretty
not.
Pretty sure it's color. Hmm. Yeah. I know. I mean, I know the opening scenes are color because I can see them in my mind. You know, there are people that cannot envision things. Like if I said, hey, can you imagine a field of wheat and a green couch sitting in the middle of the field and a scarecrow behind the couch? We can all imagine that, right? Get a picture in our mind. Mm-hmm. There are people that don't have that ability.
What is that called?
Don't know. I don't have the ability to remember the names.
Eric only remembers the first part of trivia, never the second part.
Goddamn, Lawrence. Those are the heat lines. Yeah, no, I know somebody who can't create visual pictures.
Well, I have a problem where I can't visualize speculated geometry. Like Derek will say, hey, what do you think about if we put the couch over here? And I cannot give an opinion. I'm like, I don't know. I can't visualize it. You'd have to put the couch over there for me to know if I would care. He's like, well, you just can't see it in your head. No, I can't.
Oh, well, maybe now, did you have a problem with the scarecrow imagery?
No, I got that.
Okay.
But that's not a real world thing.
What was this scarecrow wearing?
I gave plaid, him a black coat and a straw hat.
Oh, see, I see plaid.
Okay, no coat, but shirt. Would the scarecrow look better if he was sitting on the couch instead of behind it?
Scarecrows, it would be creepy if you're sitting behind it.
Scarecrows don't have leg joints by definition.
Yeah, they're on a pole. They can sit anywhere they want.
Nope. Scarecrows don't have bendable legs. My rules. My vision.
Well, get out of my head then.
You stuff the pants with hay or whatever, so there's no bending in those joints. Although I've never actually seen a scarecrow in real life, so I don't know. I think scarecrows would be creepy.
Well, that's the whole purpose.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, I think it would not just scare crows. I think I'd be looking over my shoulder all the time.
I have a scare owl at my house.
Different.
Oh.
It's not Uncanny much. Valley human. Like, okay, have you ever...
Neither is a scarecrow.
Well, no, have you... Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Unless you're talking Batman.
So I don't consider myself, like, super phobic or anything, but I once, at JCPenney, having to go buy Husky jeans as a preteen. So all these memories are bad.
I was going to say, those are traumatic flashbacks, man.
And I walked into the dressing room at Penny's, of course, by myself, and at the end, like it's a just like a little L-shaped hallway with a couple little dressing rooms. And after you turn the L, so you no longer have sight of the door, all of the back, like half of the back of this hallway was full of mannequins in various states of like being taken apart. None of them had any clothes. They were all like, it was just like a random set of torsos with heads on them and arms and weird, you know, and like a leg here and an arm here. And I found
that it, sounds like it was made for you.
I found it super creepy. Now, I can imagine creating such a thing if I had a whole bunch of extra mannequins laying around. That would be sort of fun. But stumbling upon it as a child was a little bit horrifying.
Nearly Dexter-like.
Terrifying, yeah.
Wait, I'm so jealous you got to go to Penny's because I had to go get my Husky jeans at Brewster's.
Oh, see, I didn't have the Brewster option. Worst store ever for a kid? Junior Town,
yeah.
Oh my God, that's where Grandma bought us clothes. God bless her.
those were the days.
What? Why wouldn't you like the overall?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I just had a flash memory. Got to capture these things on sound before I don't remember them anymore. I have a very vivid memory of after watching some kind of special, maybe In Search Of, on Bigfoot. I remember being scared in my bed one night, I think on Logan Street. But the combination of, I think we had an easel in my room that had like a knit winter cap like hanging on the side of it, and the like a tree branches shadow falling across the window at night, and I could not get the vision of Bigfoot out of my head.
You're describing a scarecrow.
Exactly.
I'm pretty sure that was Logan, because that was about the same time that you were like, hey, we should cut open the oranges on Mom's mini orange tree.
Oh, that was always sort of fun stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good times on Logan Street. Okay, so Dial In for Murder. Super complicated. Unnecessarily complicated, I think. And a little bit too long.
Which part was super complicated? Parts of it weren't.
Well, there's a lot of moving pieces. It wasn't indecipherable. It just had, you know, you didn't know where it was going, and it kept taking turn after turn after turn after turn.
There was a lot of unnecessary dialogue that he could have done without. There was a lot of over-explication.
Yeah, this was all exposition, absolutely. And the ending, I thought, wasn't great. We don't even have to talk about it, necessarily. But I thought the ending was way too convenient by half. Like, everything after the intermission, I thought, not great. Although, can we talk about scissors?
Is this dead again?
Well, a little bit. It wasn't the horror that was Dead Again's scissor imagery. But the fact that... she wasn't allowed to go out and have fun herself because she had to clip out newspaper clippings of her former tennis star husband's tennis career and put them in a scrapbook. But that she used the most gigantic pair of scissors. And apparently this scene was the scene where she ends up killing her supposed murderer was really hard to shoot. So there's an actual Hitchcock quote that I love.
About the asparagus?
Yes, he said... said that this was nicely done, but there wasn't enough gleam in the scissors. A murder without gleaming scissors is like asparagus without hollandaise sauce. Tasteless. So he's like, more gleam! Sort of like in Psycho. He's like, he auditioned the melons. Have you heard that story?
Yes.
Yeah, I think one of the chapters of that book is Cassava, he said.
So Dial In for Murder was budgeted at $1.4 million estimated, which is... pretty astonishing for
time. Yeah, it's a lot of money.
1954. And it says, which I don't understand, in 1954, rentals? There were no movie rentals in 1954. But for some reason, listed the rental totals. I'm assuming that this means movie theater rentals. $3 million. So it made a substantial amount of money in comparison.
Yeah, well, he was Hitchcock at the time.
$6 million worldwide, so...
And this is when he was moving from his British phase to his American phase anyway.
Oh, I guess it was Warner Brothers. So it's Warner Brothers he owed the picture, but it was filmed at Universal Studios, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. Because I think Psycho was a Universal picture, right? Because isn't that... Or is it Paramount?
I forget.
Maybe it is Paramount. It's on. I know the Psycho House was on a lot for a long time, but...
Yeah, I got nothing.
Yeah, we should... Have you seen the movie Hitchcock? About Hitchcock?
No.
Starring Helen Mirren, I think, or somebody like that. Maybe Scarlett Johansson and Helen Mirren? Somebody like that. I don't know.
I think that sounds right, but...
Because he had a thing for blondes, and he wasn't particularly handsome, but he was super smart, but unfortunately he wasn't necessarily super charming. Or he was charming the same way Jimmy Stewart was in Rope. Kind of the charming asshole.
I was surprised that Janet in Rope was not blonde.
But she wasn't really like a damsel in distress at any point either.
No.
She was a tramp. She was Janet from Three's Company.
Was the dude they killed, was he blonde?
Maybe so.
I don't think so. I think he was dark hair. Hitchcock, by the way, 2012. Anthony Hopkins as Hitchcock. Helen Mirren, Scarlett Johansson, Toni Collette, Jessica Biel, Ralph Macchio.
Well, of course.
Yes.
So.
Sweep the leg. Sweep the leg. So, you know, I thought Dial In for Murder was not my favorite Hitchcock movie. Although I recently saw The Man Who Knew Too Much. Also Jimmy Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I didn't like it very much.
Oh, I kind of like The Man Who Knew Too Much.
We should see if we can watch the...
Que Sera Sera.
Yeah, I didn't like that either.
Oh, come on.
I wanted to. Don't get me wrong. And, you know, it was a nice travel.
I think you just don't like people that sing. Come on.
No, I don't mind people that sing.
The Music Man.
One of my favorite movies was Hair, right? So...
I was going to go with Mary Poppins.
Yeah, Mary Poppins also, yes. Okay. I like Grease. I thought that was fine. I like Once.
Yeah?
Once. Quadrophenia.
Yeah, no. You were doing good there for a minute, so.
Okay, so any trivia, Brother Jay?
No, that was pretty much all I had. So,
final thoughts on Dial In for Murder.
It was a little dated in parts, but it had some interesting, like I said, it had some great camera angles and camera shots and real tension just from the way the camera was forced down in perspective.
What about the actual scissor death was pretty great. It was way more gruesome than I thought it was going to be.
It was pretty brutal for the time. I mean, the strangulation was pretty brutal too.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was pretty graphic in, you know, for the time. It was a very small set movie. That's the one thing that struck me. It was a very tight set. But it had a very anticlimactic ending. It was just such a build for such a letdown. It just was, I think it was just, it suffered from itself. So
agreed.
It should have put itself out of its own misery by the time it was over. Not terrible, but not the greatest.
Brother Drew?
Totally forgettable. I won't remember anything about this movie in a few weeks, which, you know, isn't necessarily bad. I didn't hate it. That was fine. I didn't find it particularly believable. The husband, I don't even remember the husband's name, but he was a complete and total sociopath. I mean, he had no feelings about murdering his wife at all. He didn't even seem to care that she was having an affair. It was a convenient excuse for him to put his nefarious plot into motion. So it was fine. You know, the whole thing was really contrived. And none of it would have been possible if people just used a keychain. Like, just got like a really cool looking Batman keychain to put their keys on.
Well, okay. How about, it's very nice. How about this? How about how complicated the blackmail scheme was? Like, I don't even think I understood how complicated she tried to pay the blackmail, but it never got picked up or something? Like,
I thought it did get picked up. I thought he used that to go to the dog track.
Well, maybe. But, I mean, he had to draw out all those, like, one-pound notes or whatever over the course of a year to get all this the money to pay off the guy that he basically... blackmailed into killing his wife, blah blah blah. But it seemed like, yeah, it's weird. I don't know. Yeah, I thought it was overly complicated. I thought Ray Milland did a good, I mean, he just chewed the scenery with that role. I thought it was great. It was fun to see him, even though he had a lot of exposition going on. But he was a likable villain. But everybody else, yep. Yeah.
That was my problem, is this movie just couldn't get out of its own way.
Yeah, and Grace Kelly's character was powerless to the point of being silly.
Mm-hmm. Ray Milland's whole character arc was, I'm smarter than you. I'm more clever than you. Oh, I'm not. I'm going to jail. Darn it.
Well, no, I think he was clever, but he there were all these unforeseen problems that kept creeping up.
He was Philip's cousin.
Yes.
Do you know what other movies came out in 1954?
Oh, do tell.
Rear Window.
Oh, yes. Yes, that didn't do well for this movie.
On the Waterfront.
Ah.
And Seven Samurai.
I have never seen that all the way through.
That's a pretty good year for movies.
Yep, and this is not in the top echelon. That's why it's not in the best of Hitchcock sets. It's a second tier Hitchcock.
Have you guys seen any other Grace Kelly movies?
Well, she was in Rear Window, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I listed them before. I've never seen The Country Girl.
To Catch a Thief.
I've never seen To Catch a Thief.
That's the only other one I've seen. It's good.
Yeah. Okay. So we're all big Grace Kelly fans. Actually, I think we're all Grace Kelly fans for the same reason that we were all Princess Di fans. She was just pretty and sort of royalty, and then she died tragically in a car accident.
Is that really how Grace Kelly died?
Yeah, in Monaco, I think.
With Falco? Sorry, that was a joke.
Yeah, I don't get the joke, but I'm sure it's hilarious.
Falco died in a car crash in Monaco.
Falco did? Dirk Harmasaw Falco?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
He raced cars.
Oh, okay. Yeah, she was just driving down the hill from her house, I think. But winding hills of Monaco. I could be completely wrong. We should probably fact check that.
Yeah, I've got the machine. Hold on. Grace Kelly. Yeah, Grace Kelly was driving back to Monaco from her country home in Rock.
In Iraq?
Rockagel.
Rockagel. She drove from Iraq?
When she had a... No. Rockagel. When she had a stroke. As a result, she lost control of her 1971 Rover and drove off the steep winding road and down the 120-foot mountainside.
That's no bueno.
She was alive but unconscious at the scene, transported to Monaco Hospital, later named Princess Grace Hospital of Century.
Didn't, like, her daughter find her or something? Like, come upon
her daughter was in the car. Oh. Her daughter was in the car and tried to right the car, couldn't right the car because it was just too out of control.
I couldn't help it, boss. I'm powerful tired. Couldn't help it.
Yeah, so there's that. And just for a tangent, let's see, Falco. Oh, I'm sorry. Falco died of severe injuries in a car crash when his Mitsubishi Pajero collided with a bus on the road linking the towns of Villa Montalano and Porto Plato in the Dominican Republic. So, my apologies, Monaco. I didn't want to blame you. So, I shouldn't unjustly blame you. It was apparently Guatemala.
No.
It was determined that he was under the influence
of... Dominican Republic.
I know. I was...
Okay.
Cujo.
Your Guatemalan-ness was getting in the way.
Yes. See? You ruined my joke.
Oh, apparently he was under your joke. I think Falco ruined your joke.
Under the influence of alcohol and cocaine at the time.
Oh, of course.
At the time of his death, he was planning a comeback. Aren't they always?
I'm planning a comeback right now.
I'm a huge Falco fan.
Pour one out for Falco. And get into housekeeping. Let's pour one out for Gizmo Anderson. The guinea pig.
Uh-oh.
Gizmo lived a short life, but a good life.
So Gizmo has shuffled off his mortal coil, her mortal coil.
Yes, she was shuffling a lot more lethargically last Thursday night, and on last Friday morning, I discovered her deceased with her best friend, Kuka, snuggled up against her dead body.
Well, at least they don't try and eat each other, right?
Well, maybe if they would. They're not super strict. I think they're pescatarians. They'll eat a fish if they could come across one in the wild, but I'm kidding. They don't fish, and they're nearly blind. At least Kuka is nearly blind, so... Because
I'm like, what kind of traumatic counseling would you have to get your kid if she walks in and you're one of them eating the other one?
Well...
It'd be pretty scarring, I might think.
We had to have I told Drew the story earlier, but I'll tell the brief version of the story now. This was on Friday morning, and both Kelly and I had to work on Friday morning, and this was like 5:30 in the morning when I discovered this, and Journey was still asleep because she's a very hard sleeper, and getting her out of bed in the morning is difficult. So Kelly, because I told her last night, I was like, we need to keep an eye on Gizmo because She's looking a little lethargic. And so Kelly saw me in Journey's room and was like, so how's Gizmo? And I'm like, shaking my head. She's like, she's dead? I'm like, yep. And so Kelly's like really upset. She's like, oh, we should have treated her better. I should have. You know, like, we couldn't have taken her. We're not going to take her to the vet. She cost $5. These are things I think in my head. I don't say out loud. But anyway, and then I was like, well, we need to tell Journey. And she's like, we can't tell Journey because Journey will not want to go to the Y. And neither of us can take off of work because our jobs are super chaotic right now and understaffed. So this would not be a good week for a personal day. Actually, I don't think I have a good week for a personal day until sometime around February. But so we ended up telling Journey later that night. And her question was, after, you know, I kind of presented it in a way that she guessed it. So she got the joy of being right, I suppose. She's like, after a bit, she's like, so what did you do with the body? Do we bury it? I'm like, no, we can't. We have a very small yard. We can't bury it. So, and Kelly's like, yes, we took it. Your father took it to the pound. I'm like, yeah, because I work right next to animal control. I just took it to animal control. They have a place to dispose of. What we really did was put it in a double bag, plastic bag, and put it in the garbage can.
Did you guys watch the Sopranos?
Uh-huh.
That reminds me of when Tony had to put down Richie.
Yes.
And Janice was like, what happened to the body? And Tony's like, you know, we buried him in a meadow under his favorite tree. She's like, really? He's like, no, what do you think happened to him? Jeez. We double bagged him and threw him in the garbage.
It was very respectful. We had like a little towel that we wrapped her up in and then put her in the double bag. I was worried, although it was Friday, so, and garbage day for us is Monday morning, so it was fine, but I was worried that it was going to be super hot and we're going to have like a bag explosion in the garage or something, but nothing like that happened. And now we are much more vigilant about taking care of Kuka, who is our remaining pig. And apparently guinea pigs should be in pairs at least. There are places in the world where you can't even legally own a single guinea pig because they are such... like herd animals. So we have to get another one. And I went to, there was a guinea pig named Miss Pigs who was available for adoption on Monday. So, I had a doctor's appointment. So mom had Journey basically all day on Monday. So I went from the doctor's appointment to go buy a cage because you can't just bring another guinea pig in and throw it in the cage because they'll fight each other or something.
Death match.
So you have to get a separate cage and introduce them slowly through a series of dates. So I went and bought a new cage, and then I went to the animal control, and a little old lady was taking Miss Pigs away because Miss Pigs was the featured adoptable pet of the week or whatever. So she was on, I think they showed her picture on the TV or something. And boom, animal control was at 11. I was there at noon or 12:30, and the pig was getting taken away by a wonderful new owner.
Oh, so her last name was Celica.
Last name was what?
Celica.
Celica, yes.
That's a 1% joke.
Yeah, that's okay. Yep, that's my news. Death in the family. Although it's a good way to introduce, you know, I mean, Journey knows about death from Mermy. She was there when mom and dad discovered Mermy, and not dead yet, but you know, anyway. So that was that introduction had already been made that life is fleeting. But I think we're going to have to get a pig in some way. So we may actually have to go buy a pig at some point.
Do they really need to be in pairs if you have to introduce them to each other so gingerly?
Well, that's the thing, is that there is a pair that was for adoption. Because apparently, you know, our animal control has a fair amount of cats, almost no dogs, and then the occasional rabbit, chinchilla, bird, guinea pig. Once in a while, a spider or a snake. But for the most part, it's cats and then little animals. So, which is good, which is a good thing about Alaska, or Anchorage rather, is that we don't have a huge stray dog problem. On the other hand, we do have kind of a bear problem, so maybe that's the answer there. But anyway, there were two, and then I'm like, well, should we go try to rescue two? She was like, we don't have a big enough cage, and let's get a bigger cage. I'm like, we can't get a bigger cage. It's all very complicated. Who cleans out the cage? Come on, man. Anyway, that's my housekeeping. Drew, what's your housekeeping this week?
I have to follow the dead guinea pig.
Well, I have faith in
you. Nothing too exciting, except I powered through just about the entire third season of Better Call Saul. Man. It was so good. It was so good. Michael McKean is amazing.
I haven't watched second season yet, so I've got that to look forward to.
At some point, I'll have to invest in Breaking Bad. Because actually, J-Mo, who I don't know if she's a listener or not, but if so, listener J-Mo, thumbs up. She asked me if I had seen Breaking Bad, and I'm like, no, it's on the list. She goes, it is so good. And then I asked her immediately about Better Call Saul. She goes,
Nah, she's wrong.
Yeah, well, you know. She also runs like the wind.
Oh, is that a sight?
No, she runs. She's actually, you know, those people who collect marathon shirts and make quilts out of all their marathon shirts. She has far too many marathon shirts to do that, so she does it with her triathlon shirts. She's that kind of person.
Nice.
Also, I asked her about virtual races. Do you know there are clubs where you can enter virtual races and get medals like you get when you complete a real marathon, except you just run it virtually? So theoretically, you can just send them their $25 or $50 or whatever, and they'll send you a cheap medal. And you can have a case full of medals that said you ran in all these marathons that are all virtual marathons. Like, I'm running in a virtual marathon right now.
I used to work with a guy who would do ultra marathons.
Yes, which is a weird category because there's no real rule, right?
It's a special kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Like 100-mile treks.
What?
Yeah, anything over anything over 26 miles, 26.2 is an ultra, right? But theoretically, it's 100 miles.
Is it nonstop or is it?
Oh, yeah.
So they take a break.
Yeah.
How do you not die from all kinds of nutrient and electrolyte dehydration?
Here's something that you should not Google. Do not Google marathon runners pooping themselves.
No, I mean, I think if you need to, you take rest breaks and, but you have to, I think the ones he was doing is you had to pack everything out. So you would have to carry your poop with you if you took a poop break.
And I think if you go under 3 miles an hour, they shoot you. Wait, that was a Stephen King story. Oh, sorry, Richard Bachman story.
So would they carry food and water with them then?
Yeah.
I mean, that seems like if you didn't have
everything you need, yeah.
Yeah, you got runner's goo, right? Isn't that what it's called?
For your nipples?
Well, you can apply the goo wherever you'd like. I think it's just a nutrient squeeze packet that you can
eat
in a hurry.
Well, they have a balm they put on their some of their more delicate bits because the shirt rubbing across them after a certain amount of time running will rub everything raw. So
I believe it.
But, yeah. Oof. That just sounds... That's too much work. That doesn't even sound fun. I wouldn't even be chased by a bear for 100 miles.
God, I wish I could remember the name of the Indian tribe in Mexico.
That what?
It starts with an H. It's like Guanamata or Guana... It's not Guantanamera, one ton tomato. It's... God, I can't think of it. But they are a tribe in Mexico that actually, like, part of their culture is these, like, 150-mile runs. And they also do it barefoot, no shoes, through, like, the desert and the rocks and stuff.
Are you talking about Rarámuri?
With an H?
No, it says R.
No.
Urtara Humara.
Yes. Yes. That's who it is. Not with an
H. Starts with a T.
It's the Tarahumara tribe.
It's the other H.
Yeah, well,
it's not the R, it's the other H.
There's an H in
there. It's got an H in it somewhere.
It's got it's the Tarahumara tribe that they do these ultra long runs and with no shoes. And so
the Tarahumara people could run for 400 miles nonstop.
Oh, there you go. Anyway, any other housekeeping?
I saw Dunkirk this weekend. Boyfriend Dustin and I went and saw Dunkirk.
And?
It's amazing. It is a beautiful, beautiful movie. It is amazing. It was astonishingly well shot and directed. It has very little dialogue and not a lot of music, but boy, it's pretty powerful. It's really a great movie. If you're, I don't want to say you're a war buff, but if you were a fan of history and a fan of kind of getting some of the missing pieces in dramatic form, it was a great vehicle. I went and saw it because of the movies that were out there I wanted to see. I thought this movie would be least able to be translated easily into my home theater system in a way that would do disservice to it. So that's why we went and saw it. Because, I wanted to go see the other Despicable Me movie, and I want to see Valerian. But I think either of those are acceptable at home, not needing to be in the theater. It was shot with super, super high, because it was also a 70mm IMAX cut. So it was just amazing. It was great. If you're not a war buff, or if you're looking for some heavy dialogue, this is not the movie for you. But if you want some story and some great visuals, it's absolutely worth it.
Excellent.
I was listening to a discussion of Valerian on the Slash Filmcast. And apparently the dialogue is so bad that the only way to see it is in the theater.
Well, that's what I was concerned about because, Luc Besson, director of Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, is, Fifth Element. I mean, he's all about visuals. But I saw in the trailers and in the interviews that accompany the trailers, Kara, what's her name, the model, and the other guy are so like flat that it's like a silly movie like Demolition Man, which someday we'll talk about. You get fun people like Wesley Snipes and Sylvester Stallone and Sandra Bullock, who you love all those people for various reasons. You also endure Dennis Leary, but that's okay. But these guys have nothing. There's no charisma there. Just a bunch of like blank white fuzzy eyebrow people.
You haven't seen Chronicle, huh?
No. Is she in that?
He is in that.
Oh, yeah. See? Is it
along
good?
Along with Creed. I like Chronicle quite a bit.
That Michael Jordan?
Yes. B.
Michael B. Jordan?
Mm-hmm. Also from The Wire.
Who is he in The Wire? Avon Barksdale. No. Was he a kid? He must have been a kid.
Yeah, he was a kid.
And then, I don't know if you saw on Audible, Eric, I don't know if you updated your app recently, or Drew, if you use the Audible app, that Audible rolled out the series for subscribers. John Ronson has a series called The Butterfly Effect.
Yeah.
And I'm listening to the first part of that. So far, it's pretty interesting. So.
If I read the blurb correctly, is it a nonfiction like discussion, or is it like a fictionalized?
Oh, it's nonfiction.
Okay, so it's all about basically like what, like internet porn and how it changes relationships.
Yeah, because the first part so far, I'm only halfway through the first part, is an interview with a real life guy.
Yeah, well,
Fabian.
That's what he does. John Ronson.
And he narrates it himself, who, I like him because I have a couple of his other books on Audible, and I like him. He's a great writer, I think. So yeah, I really enjoy him.
Yep. I like him as well.
The Psychopath Test is a deeply disturbing book, but...
Yeah, well... That's up Drew's alley, right?
Because I'm a psychopath?
No. Dude, weren't you... You read The Sociopath Next Door, right?
I read a book called Snakes in Suits.
Oh, okay. Because...
Which is similar.
So I assumed that that was just like an area of interest. I could be wrong. I've been wrong before.
No, I'm always interested in figuring out how to better assess those around me.
Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on a new voicemail account to leave voice messages, or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts, dial it already.